I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 45 of Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast. This episode is entitled Chasing Ghost Excursion Praxis, Rational Concepts of Operations, CONOPS, Part 2. And I'm assuming that this will be the final installment for this particular small series that I'm doing. I seem to be doing a habit of series, but I've been trying to keep these within an hour or an hour and a half, unlike some of my peers or people who are far more successful than me in the podcast world, who do extraordinarily long episodes. So maybe in the future, but for now I'll be bifurcating it. So a little bit of housekeeping. Again, I want to thank all of my listeners and all of my listeners who press their friends, colleagues, and family to also listen to this. It turns out that the Storming America podcast series that I did with four episodes turned out to be quite popular. I've gotten a lot of really positive feedback with one exception, but that one was rather ungentlemanly, and there it is. Those things are going to happen. As a matter of fact, I know I'm over the target if I get people who are either disagreeing, or vehemently opposed to the things that I have to say about that. I urge you to go to my Substack, and you'll find it in the show notes. And I did manage to put in the show notes of the previous episode on CONOPS some references that one can find if you want to get really smart about this, to include work breakdown structures and product breakdown structures as delineated in MIL Standard 881 Foxtrot, which I find, in addition to the Special Forces Planning Process link that I put in the show notes, that 881 Foxtrot, if you're able to go to that link, you can either print it out or read the PDF that is online. Here's my personal guarantee to you. If you really wrap your head around these things that I've talked about in the previous episodes and the things that I'm going to finish up in this particular podcast on concepts of operation and how to use these from an operations research, operations analysis, and corporate effectiveness or government effectiveness standards, if you apply this, if you go to work, whether you work at a small company or a large company, and you baseline concepts or requirements for a new project or a legacy project, or you're trying to make things simply go better in a particular part of the goods and services that you deliver. And of course, the DoD allegedly delivers goods and services, so the same would apply there. If you do this successfully, you do your homework, you do the tedious work, you have a large whiteboard, maybe you've got stickies, it's not going to cost you much to do this. And you bring people in a room once you've prepared everything, and you decompose, you find the child relationships to the parents of the various components using that WBS and PBS process. And then you apply the concept of operations, baselining, as I've talked about. If you combine these two things, you are going to be a hero wherever you are. And they're going to look at you and they're going to think, my God, this is like black magic. He makes fire. How does he do this? And it's simply a dirty little secret out there that if you apply these things to whatever you do, and as I mentioned before, you can even do this in your personal life and find increased effectiveness in whatever you're trying to achieve in your personal life with these things. So with that, I urge you all to take this in the degree of seriousness or solicitude you choose, and now we'll move on. Instead of repeating everything that I said in the previous episode, if you didn't listen to the previous episode, I do think, unlike other episodes I've had, that you'll want to listen to that before you do this because, well, in corporate effectiveness logo, this is not a parallel enterprise in this episode. This will be a serial enterprise. Now, we left off at the bifurcation and distinction of operational concepts or operational concept descriptions. Both of those fit the same thing. As a preamble to the actual concept of operation, so I wanted to go over that real quickly. Now, since the early 70s, two bodies of information have been distinguished. I just elucidated those. An operational concept description for any system is a system-centric description of the intended users, uses, how the system is intended to be used, and the external conditions expected during use of the system. As such, it is the definitive reference for fitness and fitment of the system for its intended use. By the way, fitment and purpose and intent all married to each other. You do this early on, and you keep abreast of this throughout the entire process. You will not deviate right or left from your original intent, and you'll find yourself getting to the place you want to go much more effectively than you thought otherwise. An OCD, an operational concept description, may also identify other stakeholders in the interest in the system of each stakeholder. If so, the OCD becomes a reference for stakeholder satisfaction. In other words, achievement of intent. Now, then we come to the raison d'etre for why we're doing these two episodes in the first place, which is the concept of operations, the CONOPS, for a given system limited to an enterprise or business or capability system, is a description of the concept of how human and technical resources within the system solution are to interact to result in the enterprise or business or capability outcome. That is, a CONOPS is a conceptual description of the operational part of the system solution. The operational part of the system solution is that part of the solution which is intended to meet the requirements on the system which serve an end-use purpose. Now, this is all very good, but until IEEE came along and issued in 1998, IEEE 1362-1998, the IEEE Guide for Information Technology System Definition Concept of Operations document, which in content is a standard for an operational concept description. Remember, that's the preamble. The resulting confusion is now history and also current reality. Now, I'm not going to go in some of the food fights that NCOSI and IEEE, and NCOSI being the Systems Engineering Collective and NCOSI being the Electrical Engineer Collective, I'm not going to go into the food fights and the Machiavellian intrigue that has informed the battle of wits that they've had over this very thing. What I've told you is sufficient. What I put in the show notes is sufficient for you guys to delve even deeper to discover what you have to do to make this real in your own lives and at the business or functionality that you currently work at. A slight diversion, an editorial comment, and that would be this. If in our lives and in the lives of the work that we do, or our families at home, or the friends or our community that we live in, if we were to all take baselining seriously, if we were to all take rational and effective concepts and requirements seriously to achieve these big efforts that we're trying to get done in our lives, both professional and personal, the world would not be the cavalcade of calamities and the series of chaos avalanches it is today. But why is that? Well, it's twofold, and I'm certain that my smart listeners can come up with other reasons, but I'll concentrate on two. I told you early in the last episode that critical thinking is really important, but it's really hard. And critical thinking is simply thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking. As I mentioned then, and I mentioned now, that's not flippant, that's reality. And the other thing is, this is tedious. It's not a fun process all the time. But once you do it, and once you put it on the whiteboard, type it up, put it in your computer, wherever you put it, share it with your team and or family. Share it with the folks who are involved in this enterprise. And then, in a two-sentence or one-paragraph intent that is approved by your leadership, you put that in font 172 on a big piece of paper, and you paste it to the wall in whatever room you're having your meetings in. And my gods, I hope they're not useless meetings. I hope you make them count, and I hope you make them actionable. You have it up there so that nobody in the room can deviate from the direction that you need to go. Because keep in mind that Lewis Carroll, in that wonderful book, Alice in Wonderland, told us, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there. Don't be a pinball. So, on with ConOps. Now, I want to repeat what I think is solid thinking concepts, terrific distillation and instantiation of what a good definition of ConOps is, because if we have a language pattern definition on what we're after, it makes it easier for all of us to agree that that's the direction that we're going. Their definition, I repeat, and I said this at the end of the last episode, is a ConOps, a concept of operations, is a formal document that employs user terminology in a specific prescribed format to describe the rationale, uses, operating concept, capabilities, and benefits of a system. Now, mind you, the only editorial comment I have for that is I would always make sure it says the benefits of a system of systems, because whether you acknowledge this or not, everything you do, especially when it comes to warfare, and my podcast series and my podcast Raison d'etre has always been about warfare and the fact that in complex adaptive environments via Clausewitzian friction, it is the greatest collision in any human endeavor. Of the collision of two or more of these complex adaptive systems, in all the chaos, all the complexity, all of the either willful, purposeful, hasty, or deliberate behavior and action on the smallest scale to the largest scale takes place. And at the end of that, we can roll the dice, and you never know, will the superior force dominate the inferior force, or vice versa? Or will something happen where via rolling the dice, or something occurs that no one extrapolated, that some unintended consequence that may appear small but measures itself in a ripple in which it becomes very large and causes a superior force to lose in a conflict, whether a battle or a war, to much smaller forces. Concepts of operations could be a planning modality that you use in warfare, or as I've mentioned before, in peacetime preparing for warfare, or in our corporate lives or our family lives. And this is the means by which you wrestle to the ground a lot of those expectations, try to extrapolate out what some of those second and third order effects are, what some of those unintended consequences are, and you cannot capture all of them. As I've mentioned in previous episodes, and that would be episode 2 and episode 4, where I first introduced the idea of anti-fragility versus fragility in human affairs and how that affects the outcome of conflicts, if not the outcome of societies at all, and that those two are things that where the effects of both fragility and anti-fragility can be mitigated by proper planning. I remember one of my leaders when I was in uniform would always tell me that, you know what, a large portion of good luck is inferred through meticulous planning. Remember what Eisenhower famously said, quote, in preparing for battle, I have always found that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. So on to ConOps. What I want everybody to take note of is that for the purpose of ConOps, we always define a system, and I would say a system of systems, as follows. An arrangement of items, components, people, or organizations that are interrelated and which interact in some way with humans or human surrogates in the loop to form a larger or greater entity or to accomplish a larger task. Now, one thing that I say human surrogates, of course, is because of the advent of machine learning and AI and the present impact that that's having on society. Now, the concept hierarchy, picture an umbrella chart in which at the top you have ConOps. Underneath the ConOps, you have two items. You have the operating concept, and then you have another operating concept. Now, those operating concepts are bifurcated. On the left-hand side, you have concept of employment. And on the right-hand side, you have functional description. Now, ConOps can be nested, and you can have other ConOps, but in order to achieve a simplicity in this podcast, and since I'm not talking to you via video or via whiteboard, I want to keep it as simple as possible. So there's five pillars of ConOps. There's completeness, what we're fixing, making sure the opcons, remember the opcons are the preamble to the conops themselves, are as-is and future scenarios. Because, as some of the old lads would say, you can't possibly know where you are if you don't know where you've been. So it sort of tickles the historian in me to know that they're giving a nod here to the fact that you need to know your as-is condition in order to go into the future, and you need to instantiate that, and you have the moral, and you have to have the moral courage to be truthful about what that very condition looks like. Now, number two is going to be input from current hands-on users, folks who have both the unconscious competence, maybe the book learning, maybe the experiential database from having been in a particular industry or line of work for the longest time. You want to listen to those people. You want to have crisp, clear writing, inactive voice, and you want all your important points to be up front, to include a bluff, which is your bottom line up front. You want a concise, unambiguous graphic, and this is appropriate to everything that you do. In the DOD, the Department of Defense, they refer to this as an OV1, which is a high operational view. It's an operational viewpoint. It's a high-level operational concept graphic. An OV1, operational viewpoint 1. There are other OVs, SVs, and other things that I'm not going to get into here because it just begs the question of how to stay contained within the amount of time that I have in order to give you the data that you need for this initial précis and primer on how this is done. And then you'll need a predictive, intuitive format for easy reading, which is usually in a paragraph format. Now, the CONOPS definition for the U.S. DOD, NATO, and international uses, and the military, it's a formal document that describes using user terminology in a specific prescribed format. And you'll look at my show notes and you'll find some of those formats. The rationale, uses, operating concept, capabilities, and benefits of a system. Now, there are formats. Again, I'm not going to go over those here. I may try to plug that format into the show notes, but for the purposes of this primer, we're not going to belabor that point. So, and I want you to keep this in mind. A CONOPS process sounds deceptively simple. It is tedious. But you must decide what you're trying to do. And usually you don't want to do that by consensus or democracy. You want to have a leadership entity in the room that will tell you exactly what direction that intent is going. You need to agree on the components that comprise the system or system of systems you're describing. Then you need to describe those components. And I find that the PBS, WBS, that product breakdown structure, a work breakdown structure that I spoke of in the previous episode, is a terrific way to really lay that out. You want to describe how those components work together operationally now. You want to describe the changes needed by describing shortfalls. Again, it demands moral courage, whatever you have in front of you, of describing shortfalls, because people in the room may own it or they may be responsible for having developed it, and you need to be able to look them in the eye and tell them that, well, this is the way it is in reality. And then you need to show how that resulting system will perform operationally once changes are made. And this is arts and sciences. By the way, the DOD and many departments in the government make concepts of operations and functional descriptions and all these kinds of things mandatory. But if you ask them for evidence that at their baselining part of whatever they're embarking upon to create a good or service, if you want evidence of that happening, I would bet you, even in the Pentagon, half the time, they will not be able to provide you with the written evidence that they went through that process. In order for these CONOPS to be robust and useful, you've got to make sure that you've conjoined the CONOPS building process, which is going to be your research, your subject matter experts, your SMEs, and your writing. You've got to have people skills, which is going to be your leading, your negotiation, your problem solving being the largest part of this, because if you're not seeking or trying to solve a problem, don't do this process in the first place because it doesn't serve well. And, of course, project management skills, come in here, which includes the planning, the budgeting, the executing, and everything for those listeners who have either been on a project management team or actually led those teams. Now, I've got to tell you that failure anywhere here in this process is going to be fatal to an effective ConOps. Now, there's obvious benefits of building these solid and useful concepts of operations. Again, I would tell you that these are useful no matter the size of the program. Could be in your personal life. I've used it to improve things such as my shooting capabilities and my efficacy in things that I do for hobbies. Because you're identifying key components, subsystems, communications paths, messages. You're establishing a common vision. It surfaces hidden assumptions that you didn't see in the first place because you didn't take the time to go through this tedious process to force those things into the open. And it clarifies issues and interdependencies. Well, that's a big word, interdependencies. It means exactly what you think it means. You wouldn't be listening to my podcast if you weren't bright and intellectually curious. So what is an interdependency? It seems like it's from the University of the Intuitively Obvious, and it is. What it means is those things that depend on one another through some kind of cross-disciplinary ferment or within the same discipline, but various sub-disciplines that have to work together. Remember I made mention in the last episode, so a chemical engineer and an electrical engineer had lunch one day, and they said, man, you know, with your skill set and mine, I'll bet we can come up with an automotive battery. Voila, automotive batteries. Because as I mentioned, genius and innovation finds a much bigger home when it comes to cross-disciplinary ferment. Now, at times, you're going to have unintentional results of these ConOps. And requirements can be impacted far downstream if you don't get all your ducks in a row at the beginning. Readers' thoughts are shaped, often subconsciously, especially if you're in a room surrounded by people who have an unconscious competence in the very discipline or variety of disciplines that you're pursuing. Now, as you know, there is a certain class of people that all of us have been exposed to. Maybe some of my listeners happen to be in this class, and those are people that are threatened by changes proposed. And you need to bring that into the open, talk that out, and figure out why that's the case. In others, similar projects are threatened. Poor ConOps can cost millions of dollars, delay programs for years, or get them canceled. But I'm here to tell you, I'd much rather have poor ConOps than no ConOps at all, because I mentioned earlier, Lewis Carroll said, you know, if you don't have a particular direction you're going in, you're going to end up wherever you go. And you don't want to do that when you're involved in purposeful agency for constructing goods and services, no matter in the government, in the military, in the private sector. That's just a bad way of doing business, period. Now, all formal ConOps have four key points. Where we are now, instantiating the state of nature of where you are now. What changes are desired in order for you to improve or get better effectiveness? What's the desired end state after those changes? What is the intent? It's so important, like I mentioned earlier, in two sentences or a paragraph, to have an intent that your leadership approves, and for the most part, you want buy-in from all of the minions who are going to be working on it, and you want that intent to be what guides you the entire way, and then you don't deviate from the task, and you stay within the scope of what you're trying to achieve. And, speaking of intent, wouldn't it be great also to have illustrative examples of that end state? So what I'm going to do, once again, operating from the constraints of speaking to you guys via audio and not having a whiteboard in front of us, nor a video or a video conference room in which I can illustrate some of these points, so bear with me. What you want to do is flesh out what the problem is that's being addressed. What's the operational problem that this system addresses? And with this system or system of systems, in this case, because of the flavor of my podcast, we're going to approach this from a military perspective. So with this system, or system of systems, what will warfighters, or maybe first responders, be able to do that they can't do now? Who says this is a problem? And are there any published needs that exist? Again, what we're trying to do is frame the problem, isolate the problem, wrestle it to the ground, and make sure that that problem is consistent with the intent of what we're trying to achieve in the first place. And where and when does this problem occur? Under what conditions? What other capabilities are impacted or curtailed by this problem? And if we don't fix this problem, what's the result? Try to clarify what it looks like. If we're not able to achieve and we fail at what we're doing, where does it leave us? Now, the concept is then selected for further consideration. You do a thumbnail sketch, as I talked about for the high-level operational concept graphic in OV1. That OpCon that I referred to earlier, that is the preamble to your ConOps. Are there three or four primary nodes? Are there more primary nodes? If they are, again, you have to wrestle those to the ground. Inputs and outputs for each node. What missions are supported with this? What other warfighter systems are impacted? Is it a zero-sum game? Could they work in concert? Are other war systems, as a result of what you're doing here, do they have to be modified? Do they have to be replaced? The Army provided me with a fabulous rule set that I have used all my adult life after being introduced to it in 1979 when I first went into the service. And that was what's referred to as task conditions and standards. And again, this comes from the University of the Intuitively Obvious. All it is this, and it's so simple. And I keep it in mind even with the more high-level ConOps discussion that we're having right now. What's the task at hand? Under what conditions must the task be achieved? And what are the standards for successful implementation or performance of that task? Task conditions and standards, TCS. Again, you can use that in your private life, in your business life, or anything, and you'll find it very useful. You're welcome. Now, operational considerations for implementing the concept that we've all agreed on. How do the operators use this system? What skill levels will be required to operate the system? Who will train the operators? The maintainers? How will they be trained on the system? How long will it take for operators and maintainers to become proficient with this system? Until government people are proficient, will contractors be available to operate, maintain the system? In other words, field service representatives, FSRs. Who maintains the system? What's the maintenance philosophy? 2-level? 3-level? Can the existing maintenance arrangement support the system or system of systems? If not, what changes are needed? What facilities will be needed for the system? Can existing facilities be used or will new ones be needed? And, of course, this is important to everybody, who will pay for the system and what's going to be the color of the money? And please keep in mind that what I'm offering you up is candidate questions. I am certain that you can come up with pages, volumes, many volumes, of questions that are appropriate to whatever your talent stack or whatever complex of operations that you're involved in at work, whether it's government, military, private sector, whatever the case may be. A lot of these problems have a lot of things in common in how to achieve an effective intent and how to get there using concepts of operation. Other questions would be, will the government have sufficient visibility into the system's architecture and code to access the software's robustness and stability? Who will own the IP for the system? That's a big deal among defense contractors because it is IP and algorithms that allow them to maintain their silos of excellence so that they can make money. What ancillary support equipment will the system require? What kind of testing will there be? What kind of data exchanges? It goes on and on as far as these questions. You will find in MIL Standard 881 Foxtrot. Yeah, I think that's the one I recommended to you guys. I think it's nearly 300 pages. A lot of these questions are inferred there. A lot of them, there's a lot of lists in there to aid you in the decomposition that you need to achieve a true understanding of the problem. So I want to take a brief pause here to tell you why all this is so bloody important. A concept of operations allows you to have situational understanding, not simply situational awareness. Those two bifurcations occur among soldiers and warfighters in the West, which is that situational awareness is, it's obvious that I'm in a fight. It's obvious that maybe this is trench warfare. It's obvious that both the enemy and myself just so happen to be subject to drone attack. Situational understanding is, well, I take that awareness to the next level because I grok what the future holds for me if I think it through. Situational awareness lets me establish, here I am, I'm on the ground, I'm in the mountains, I'm in a forest, maybe I'm in a littoral area, maybe I'm in the jungle. I know what's going on around me, but I don't have an understanding necessarily of what's going on around me. Situational understanding is what the concept of operations allows you to do for whatever you're embarking upon in your given area of expertise or talent stack. By the way, for those of you who didn't listen to my critique of management consulting and the management culture in America and the West, I would urge you to do so. That would be episode 39, CG Excursion, Stoicism, Who Dares Leads, where I do a very firm critique along with Matthew Stewart in his brilliant book about why there is so much garbage out there when it comes to management consulting and management culture and management gurus. I'm certain that a number of you who are working in big corporate America or even big military America, maybe you've worked at the Pentagon or you're in a major fighting organization where all of a sudden they come up with this 300-page book. I won't say what the titles are, but you can guess what they are. And of course, all of those books can be explained in 10 pages instead of 300 pages. But the reason why you're forced to read those is because all of a sudden your organization will become much more effective than it is if everybody on the leadership team reads these books. Now, there is a book by James Clear called Atomic Habits that I have found to be an exceptionally good book and worth the time. As a matter of fact, I've come up with a 10-page summary for my teams and for my family of the book. But of all the management books out there, it's the one that I found is most useful. And probably it's one that's useful out of hundreds, if not thousands, that are not so useful. Now, by the way, there are other views of concepts analysis in order to arrive at these CONOPs. The process of building CONOPs is much more important than the document or checking the box or pencil whipping this. You're wasting your time if you're doing this simply to achieve or check a box to say that it's been done and you don't do the process itself. Because what the process itself does in assessing both the successes and foibles of a given organization, because one thing that the concept of operations does reveal in its process is what the limitations are of a given entity in achieving what that intent is that they set out to do. And this entire process, again, if you have the moral courage to do it correctly, and you ask all the right questions, and you do it Elon Musk style, where you have full open Komodo, where all your failures, foibles, and misapprehended successes, which may not be successes in the first place, you lay them all out on the table to make sure that you are going in a truthful fashion that allows you to get there without fooling yourself into thinking you have something that you don't. Now, again, I'm going to throw out some terms here, but remember, I don't have any expectation of anybody, except maybe the most seasoned CONOPS warrior that's out there listening to this by chance. I don't expect you to have mastered this process by listening to a short, abbreviated overview of it on my podcast. What I'm hoping I do is that I sate your intellectual curiosity enough to seek this out, find ways in order to study how this process works, bring that process to your organization, and it will make you more effective, and your organization, and your entire corporate ecology, more effective at what you do, and I guarantee it. Because the optimal sequence for events for this is going to be that concepts analysis that I talked about, that operational concept that is a preamble to the actual CONOPs themselves, and in the CONOPs, you're going to have an overview, you're going to have an architecture, and then an architecture going to speak to how you operationally make this happen. And then, of course, that leads to your design function. And then, of course, it leads to the constant, persistent, and perennial reviews of whatever you've done so that you can have an iterative fashion of improving and making better on what you've made better in the first place. I could speak for hours, days, weeks on how to do this effectively. But nonetheless, we're confined to 2 hours minus in a short podcast series. I hope that I've convinced you that the ConOps process, conjoined with a work breakdown structure and the product breakdown structure process, and you'll see that in the show notes, is really a laudable way to make your organizations function in a more optimal fashion. One of my trades is I'm an operations research, operations analysis, and operations research analyst. And our core job is we make organizations more effective and we make things better. There is an apocryphal story of noticing things that go unnoticed by most people because people aren't paying attention. During World War II, B-17s were coming back. I'm sure that maybe you've seen Masters of the Air, which is a superlative film series that just came out that riffs off of The Pacific and Band of Brothers. I highly recommend it if you get a chance to watch it. Well, these planes, B-17s, but also others, but in this case, operations analysts were asked to look at these graphics that they had. And in those graphics, they had a picture of a B-17. You're looking down on it, and the thing is filled with holes. And they said, what do we need to augment or reinforce on this aircraft to ensure that, obviously, these are airworthy, they've come back, but all these holes are here. The holes are in the tail. The holes are in the wing. But yet, they still managed to come back. Now, what a keen operations analyst knew was that that wasn't the whole story, because the whole story was, I'm concerned with the aircraft that didn't come back and how did they get hold? Because obviously, all the holes that I'm seeing from the top down when I get a bird's eye view of that B-17 on the deck in England after it's come back from a particularly stormy and bullet-ridden journey, yet it still makes it back. Crew are probably killed or wounded, but nonetheless makes it back with all these holes. I'm concerned where is the places on the B-17, for instance, that were hit that caused them not to come back. And that's what operations analysts do, and that's what you have the opportunity to do if you take concepts of operations and concepts and requirements baselining at the beginning of small projects, everything up to very large projects, and everything in between. Now, what I've discovered is that I find this process tedious, hard, difficult, not an easy sell. It's not an easy thing to do. It's sort of like critical thinking, but even harder. I think that when it comes to major weapons programs, and I'm going to confine myself to my critiques of the U.S. Navy as we speak, that when we look at the little crappy ships, ever since the 1990s, ever since the issuance of the Arleigh Burke destroyer class, which was the last gasp of an effective surface Navy ship that the U.S. Navy has commissioned. Everything after that has been hot garbage. Whether it's the littoral combat ship, whether it's the F-35 Bravo and Charlie being the designators for the Navy and Marines so that they can have the STOL takeoff off the decks of reinforced carrier decks that can take the heat of the STOL VTOL vertical launching of the F-35. When you look at that program, you look at the LCS, you look at the USS Zumwalt, please, and if I'm telling you stuff that you don't recognize, just look it up. There's plenty of articles and even books out there that talk about these. And then you have the USS Ford, which is supposed to succeed the Nimitz, which has had three other platforms, maybe two other carriers, and their hulls approved to be laid down and constructed. Not only did that construction take place in a much longer period of time than it should have, but we presently have the USS Ford, which cannot reliably launch and retrieve aircraft. What they decided to do was something called concurrent technology, and obviously they didn't do their ConOps because it's real hard to do ConOps when you have concurrent technology, which means that the technology isn't mature at the time, but you're hoping it's mature once it comes down line. Now, mind you, we have a replacement for the Arleigh Burke, and that is the Constellation Frigate. We should have had the first one in 2026, but right now it looks like it's going to be 2029. They are building this frigate, and I'm certain it's going to have significant cost overruns, with incomplete designs during the building process. That's insanity. But going back to the USS Ford, it cannot reliably launch or retrieve the F-35 aircraft, which aren't very reliable in the first place. I spoke to these things in my episode that I did on carriers. That would be episode 34, CG Excursions, Deep Six, the Carrier Force, Naval Power in the 21st Century. And so I won't belabor the point too much, but I will give you a brief précis of what some of those problems are. That concurrent technology was electromagnetic pulsing for the launching and retrieval of aircraft to include the 11 weapons elevators that are on board. Somehow, some way, all 11 weapons elevators were designed to operate in serial, which means that if one weapons elevator goes out, all weapons elevators go out. Four steam cats, and I expect listeners, especially those of you, me, having never been a carrier aviator nor served on a carrier, maybe with your experience therein, you can correct my numbers. My numbers are that a steam cat is recognized as having steam catapult. Is recognized as having a mean time between failure of 1 and 35,000. Now, between 1 and 125 and 1 in 600, I can't pin down what the number is. That mean time between failure and electromagnetic launch system and retrieval system is such that that's what it is. That's abominable, especially when you talk about sortie rotations. Sorties being that single time that an aircraft goes out, completes its combat radius, and God's willing, returns to the carrier deck. That sortie generation in a 24-hour period of time in a medium to high threat environment may very well exceed that 1 in 125. Maybe it would be 48 hours. Maybe it would be 72 hours. Have you noticed, from a bird's eye view, when you look at carrier deck construction in the West, you find that that actual launch point, when we're looking down on that carrier, is canted off to port approximately 5 to 8 degrees, I would guess. Why is that? It's so that if an aircraft happens to launch and the launch is incomplete, the ship doesn't run it over because it has been deployed at an angle. You must understand the physics of carrier aviation. I'm in wonder that we achieved this in World War II. And if you read a great book by James Hornfisher called The Fleet at Flood Tide, America at Total War in the Pacific, 1944 to 1945. He does an absolutely splendid job. He passed, and that's too bad. He does an absolutely splendid job of talking about the way the Navy, in a matter of 4 years in the Pacific, erected what could be referred to as an entire Pacific civilization with 7,000 ships, among which was 100-plus fleet carriers. We presently have 10 to 11, maybe 12, but with the OR rate of 1 in 3, maybe 3 or 4 that are available at this time to be deployed in wartime circumstances. Nonetheless, carrier aviation for jets, and he talks about this in his book, Who Can Hold the Sea, where he talks about the U.S. Navy in the Cold War from 1945 to 1960, and as I mentioned, he died prematurely. What a terrific loss to naval historians. And wasn't able to bring us into contemporary times by finishing that book up. But nonetheless, with carrier-borne aviation, when it is jet-powered, what it means is that the combination of the leap off the deck by the catapult system and full-throttle velocity of the aircraft, if it loses one of those things, it has insufficient lift at the end of the aircraft carrier to take it aloft and ends up in the drink, hoping to rescue said aviator. Notice I didn't say pilot. I don't want my naval listeners giving me a hard time via comms. So we don't have a reliable carrier in the Ford class. They're laying down two more hulls. They still haven't solved this problem. Like the nuclear power plants built into these very large carriers, these are super carriers, It's not a matter of going in and lifting a lid and taking it out. In order to replace what appears to be a failed EMALS electromagnetic system for both retrieval and launching of aircraft, it's not a matter of bringing it into port, maybe even put it in dry dock, lifting the deck off and replacing it with a steam cat. It's built into the guts. The entire ship would have to be taken apart and reconfigured and refabbed for that steam catapult system. Right now, there is nothing on the horizon that tells us that the electromagnetic system that they're using for launching and retrieval is going to be fixed anytime soon. It's like that old adage of you had only one job, and in the case of carriers, and as those who are familiar with my notions on carriers, I think that they are the crossbow and the chariot of the 21st century, but I happen to be a minority viewpoint when it comes to that. But nonetheless, when you look at the Ford, when you look at the Zumwalt, when you look at the little crappy ship, and now you look at the Constellation frigate that they've come out with, which is a destroyer minus, none of those, I guarantee you, and I would love to see the footnotes and receipts from the U.S. Navy and the planning boards and all of the industrial defense combines, because, by the way, there is a very large aircraft carrier industrial base association. I would love to go to that industrial base association and say, please show me the CONOPS for this ship. I'd love to go to the other industrial base associations for those who have built the Zumwalt, for those who have built the little crappy ships, the littoral combat ships, which are being retired 5 years into their 30-year terms of service because they're unusable ships. I think they'll probably make better homes underwater on the seafloor for fish than for anything they could achieve for the U.S. military. Now, I'm picking on the Navy, and the Air Force is just as guilty. The Army is just as guilty. The Marine Corps is probably the least guilty of all, even though what the Commandant has done with Force Design 2030 just makes me shiver to think that they would not only abandon their tanks, not only abandon their artillery, not only abandon their maritime connector from ship to shore, relying on vertical envelopment by helicopter, but confining themselves to one theater. And this instantiated itself 18 months ago when there were crises in Africa that traditionally would be answered as a 911 call to the U.S. Marine Corps and their forces afloat, but had to be satisfied by U.S. Special Operations forces out of Europe who had to come down and fill in the gap, because the Marine Corps has been in the process of eviscerating themselves as a combat force that is an amphibious combat force. My question here to all of this is that all of this deformation, bad planning, bad organizational structure, and a future that looks more and more like it's going to be a future of conflict with near-peer and peer competitors to U.S. power. What are we doing about that from a concept of operations perspective, from a baseline perspective, from taking it so that we look at these problem sets, we're sober, and we're going to reveal to ourselves, hopefully, all the warts and ugliness underneath, all of those things that we have to fix. For the longest time, I had supposed that the discriminator for U.S. military power planet-wide was the nuclear submarine force that we presently have. And I thought to myself, well, the Navy's not doing it. The Air Force isn't doing it. Our atomics, our triad, is aging in a huge way. Hence, you've probably seen in the news lately where they are asking to lob two tridents to see just how effective these are, because America stopped nuclear testing in 1991. We have what is possibly an arthritic, sclerotic, and antiquated nuclear warhead system that hasn't been tested except in modeling. And what all military commanders will tell you is that modeling is one thing. The real world is quite a different thing from that modeling. Well, my faith is shaken in the submarine force. And at the Libertarian Institute, where I blog, I had posted a blog about the submarine force, and it's pretty awful. Let me read a little bit out of that. May 23rd, 2024, my blog entry was, "The U.S. Submarine Force is Sunk." When you look at the larger disaster of American arms and readiness, as I was just delineating, all the services are in the hazard of being mission ineffective. The U.S. Navy surface fleet has been an unmitigated building debacle, with the little crappy ships, the Zumwalt class, and the USS Ford carrier not performing up to speed for any of the anticipated mission sets. As I mentioned, I've always thought that U.S. nuclear force, we have no diesel submarines, our U.S. nuclear submarine force was the number one discriminator because no one on Earth comes close to the capabilities nor the number of nuclear submarines that we field. Now, Captain Jerry Hendricks, who, by the way, has also wrote disturbing essays about the carrier forces, and was the first one sort of to clock me in the head and say, maybe you should reconsider the paradigm of the carrier in the late 20th century and the 21st century. Well, he wrote an essay on there, and his indictment is it's well-researched, terribly disconcerting, and a dim prognostication for future strength. Quote, "Of the submarine force already in commission, 16 of those 49 boats, or nearly a third of the Navy's premier offensive force, are in dry docks or tied to piers, lacking required dive certifications." By the way, several years ago, probably a decade ago, there was a metallurgical kerfuffle because they discovered that one of the defense contractors had been lying to the Navy about the metallurgical certification for the metal that was used for the holes in the submarine. And I would think to myself, why wasn't the Navy double-checking on delivery once they got them to ensure that that metallurgical sufficiency was in place? I go on. Here's his quote. "The bottom line is that the American submarine force, the point of the spear of American power, upon which so many military plans depend, is unprepared to meet the current threat environment, and there are no quick fixes. It has taken decades and a sequence of bad assumptions and poor decisions to fall into the current state of unpreparedness, and it will take years as well as significant investments in both new ship construction and submarine repair capacity to recover." End of quote. And the other thing that he goes on to mention is that we only have two nuclear-capable shipyards in the United States. And Commander Salamander, one of my favorite navalists out there when it comes to opinions, he's the one who introduced me to the Hendricks essay. He said, and I quote, "Back to the effects of bad assumptions. The issue really isn't the bad assumptions. In all human institutions, you have imperfections and bad assumptions that don't survive for long in the wild. The key is how fast you can notice the error and then take corrective action. If you quickly execute bad assumptions, but then, in an accretion-encumbered, happy-talk-laden, and bureaucratically inept manner, slow roll the correction, well, you find yourself here." End of quote. I am less optimistic than Commander Salamander. Thank you, Captain Jerry Hendricks, for that essay. I'll be sure to put that in the notes so that you can read them. As a matter of fact, what I'll do is I will pin my blog post there because it has both Commander Salamander's comments and Hendricks's comments. My observation from all of this, and of course you have root causes and proximate causes in engineering, is that from that root cause, proximate causes start to ripple out. Again, my favorite phraseology that I employ, which is chaos avalanches. All of these are chaos avalanches. I'm here to tell you that a proper concept of operations and the employment of a lot of the things that I've talked about during this episode and the previous one, if all of those were employed in a sober and brutal manner, as in the military we call the murder boards, where all bets are off, we're going to be brutally honest, we're going to have the moral courage to ask the correct questions, none of that was done for any of these things. So I suspect when you look at almost every major platform and weapons system, regardless of service, that we currently have in service in the U.S. Armed Forces, will be insufficient to meet what has to be done in a near-peer or peer competitive war against Russia, China, or whoever else we find ourselves against in the remainder of this century. I don't have the faith that we've done the homework at the other end of the design line to have arrived at a commodity, product, or platform end of the line and issued out to the forces that works effectively. I think many of my listeners are used to my cynicism and my dark thoughts about the absolute insufficiency of U.S. and Western armed forces. I stand by that. I welcome your comments. I welcome your dissension. I welcome your illumination of why I may be incorrect. You can reach me at my Substack, where every one of these particular podcasts and every one of my dispatch essays, which are in the interregnum between my fortnightly cadence and issuance of the podcast itself, there's comments that can be left there. You can comment directly to me via email at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I urge all of you, if you get the opportunity, research these things for yourselves. But I have, if I may be so bold, offered you up a very powerful tool to change your professional and private life for the better. So, thanks for joining me. Thanks for listening. This is Bill, out.